At one time, the Chinese started out to attack Tibet and Indochina. At the same time, the North Koreans attacked South Korea. The North Koreans were very successful for a while, and therefore the Chinese didn't have to divert any forces to the support of the North Koreans. But as soon as the North Koreans were beaten, then the Chinese began diverting forces from elsewhere in order to support the North Koreans. Now then, it seems that that interpretation of the history of this episode would indicate that the Chinese have their own imperialistic purposes to serve in this
I would take the opposite view. It seems to me that you can say that the Chinese didn't interfere in the Korean affair until United Nations forces came right to the frontier and the Chinese felt that they might go on and right into Manchuria or Taiping. Consequently, what you have said would seem to suggest to me that the objectives of Mao are defensive.
But
and I'd like
the United Nations declaring, people in the United Nations and Austin and others declaring all the time there is no intention to conduct any aggressive action against China, it seems to me that unless they were willing to cheat themselves, that they would have assumed that there was no aggressive intention against China.
Well, I should think if their objectives were imperialistic, they would have intervened while we were hanging on by our teeth at Pusan, and not until we had got right up to the Chinese frontier.
Not if they thought it was unnecessary, if the North Koreans could do it without their help.
Well, that's a possible argument, but I think what you have said can go either way. I'd like to say just a word about Locke's argument concerning the interest China might have in a movement into Burma or the South. I'm inclined to think you are exaggerating the possibilities because of the very feeble communications. The Burma Road isn't very good. It doesn't seem to me that China would find it easy to mobilize forces in Burma. And also, if she would find it very difficult to get very much rice or other foodstuffs from Burma because of the very poor communications.
I think you've got to remember the case of Tibet, right? Tibet is also very difficult of access. The Chinese communists managed to get there. They managed to stimulate a native movement, as they say. And it seems to me that in the case of Burma, a country that has been independent since 1948, a country where you have a government that is extremely shaky, the possibility of boring from within is very great indeed. Now, as far as communication with Burma is concerned, I agree that the Burma Road is no answer to it. The possibility, however, of working a pincers from Burma and Indochina on Thailand and down the Malay Peninsula is, it seems to me, an initial military objective. After a time, then it will be possible, it seems to me, to establish communications in a peacetime situation.
There's a vast difference between Burma and Tibet. Tibet has no military resources of her own. She's not a member of the United Nations, and there was no possibility of the United Nations intervening to defend Tibet. On the other hand, Burma,
the possibility of the United Nations
and Burma is a sea coast, and I think it has a sea coast, and I think that there's every expectation, at least China should assume there would be, that if Burma, which is a member of the United Nations, were attacked, that the United Nations would come to its assistance.
May I suggest that Burma's a far distance from Korea and that we ought to get back to the Korean question? One of the problems that concerns me about the Korean question is that one of the objectives of the Russians may very well be not merely to tie down troops there, but to make us let up on our industrial effort. That seems likewise a possibility that is very serious and that may lead to protracted armistice negotiations and then protracted political diplomatic negotiations afterwards.
I think there's a great deal in that, and that seems to me to militate against the idea that this will be followed by military operations in other places. If the real objective of the communists is to slow down American military preparation, it seems to me we could anticipate that they would make a protracted peace in Korea and everywhere else.
You really think a truce can last, then? Right?
Well, if that's their interest, not forever, but if they want to get the Western peoples to thinking they don't need to rearm anymore, it seems to me they would have to assume that they can't get that result unless they stop the fighting for quite a long time.
Well, now, what about what about the major diplomatic issues that are going to be left over after a truce is signed? It seems to me we've got at least three different problems that ought to be taken into consideration. The question of recognition for the Chinese communists, which involves the whole question of Chiang being shelled, the disposition of Formosa, the question of the Japan Treaty. It seems to me that, first of all, this question of the recognition of the Chinese communists and their admission to the UN is one of the most pressing problems with which we are confronted. The United States is certainly in no position nowadays to extend national recognition. I think, on the other hand, that Secretary Acheson's policy of a number of months ago might very well be readopted and readapted after the conclusion of this truce that we're talking about today. I mean, simply, that the United States might abstain in bringing about the admission of China to the United Nations.
Well, I think that we're very likely to do that, and of course, if we do not recognize the Chinese communists, we can't even begin the political negotiations. It seems to me there may be a long time of military truce without political settlement. And as you say, the political settlement depends on the Chinese communists either being admitted in the United Nations or recognized by the United States. Now, in regard to Formosa, which you referred to, that is an issue which I think would depend upon what we do in regard to recognition of the Chinese communists. If we do recognize them as government of China, then we have to recall that the Cairo Declaration, to which the United States subscribed, stated that Formosa ought to be part of China. And consequently, we recognized that soon after the war and made no objection to Chiang Kai-shek, who was then the government of China, taking over Formosa. So if we recognize the communists as a government of China, I think it might be a little difficult to avoid saying that they are entitled to Formosa.
What do you think about the possibility of the independence of Formosa?
Well, that's a possibility, and of course, if we find there's a strong self-determination movement, as some people say there is, among the 6 or 7 million Chinese Formosans, we might say, under the general principles of self-determination, that should supersede the Cairo commitment.
Well, in addition to the complications of Formosa and recognition of the Chinese communists in the United Nations, there's the problem of the general peace with Japan. Now, I noticed the proposed peace treaty indicates that Japan may decide for herself whether to communicate with the nationalist China or communist China or both. Well, the solution as to whether Japan will recognize communist China will may be taken out of our hands. But the Russians have already indicated they don't like that treaty. They've already indicated that our proposal to make peace with Japan is, as they say, has an obvious aggressive character. So that the whole question of peace with Japan may tie up with this question of Korea and make the complications after the armistice, assuming you can get an armistice, so difficult that all we'll have is a continuation of the old situation.
Well, that's quite possible. As I say, I think we may simply have the status quo ante, and it may go on for a long time.
Well, in summarizing your various stands, it seems to me, right, that if I understand the thing correctly, you believe that this truce is probable.
Yes, I think the signature of an armistice is possible and is probable. I think that the armistice can initiate a durable cessation of hostilities. It seems to me that it may pave the way for an eventual political settlement, but the two things should be regarded as quite distinct, and I don't anticipate that this is going to end the Cold War or even end political antagonism between the United States and the Communist government of China.
The difference between Wright and myself is largely one of emphasis. I have the feeling that each side wants to stop the war, but both sides want to appear to have won the war, and neither side, unfortunately, has any confidence in the other, and that will present complications. But I am still hopeful. I'm hopeful that a truce will come without a renewal of big-scale hostilities. As far as a permanent solution to the Korean question is concerned, however, I am less hopeful. I anticipate a protracted period of intermittent crises with both sides standing on the alert and ready to jump at each other at the drop of a hat. I also expect, as does Wright, that the negotiations with the communist Chinese will prove baffling for a long time to come and will drag on and on.
Well, I agree with both of you that I think the truce is probable. I do think that overall peace negotiations are unlikely in the very near future. On the other hand, it seems to me we've got to think about more seriously about the question of resumption of hostilities. And I'm very much convinced that this is quite likely in the Far East, with China moving southward. The food problem is apparently so acute that the Chinese communists are faced by the need for some kind of victory in order to ensure themselves of continuing strength at home. Moreover, I think they have to keep pressing outward for the short-term propaganda gain and long-term food supply about which I was speaking earlier.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's University of Chicago roundtable on the riddle of a Korean ceasefire were Louis Gottschalk, historian, Quincy Wright, expert on international law, and Donald Locke, historian, all of the University of Chicago. The printed pamphlet of today's roundtable discussion contains the full text of the discussion and publishes special supplementary materials on today's topic and letters and comments by roundtable listeners. Be sure to write to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, to secure your copy of today's pamphlet. Single copies are 10 cents in coin. A full year subscription to the Roundtable pamphlet costs only $3. Enclose $3 with your order and make your subscription begin with today's program. I'll repeat the address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. May we invite you to join the Roundtable home study courses in human rights, world politics, and economics in the modern world. These courses are open to all, and two of them are college credit courses. You may enroll and begin at any time. Write the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, for the brochure describing the courses and telling how you may register. Each month, three 24-volume sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica are awarded to the students in the three home study courses most successfully completing the course in that month. Today's program originated from the Mitchell Tower Studios of the University of Chicago. The Roundtable is a public service presentation by NBC. This is NBC, the national broadcasting company.